Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Where you start can determine where you end up. Can, notice. Growing up in poverty does not mean you'll stay poor, but it'll take some work to get out. Our next guest did the work, got out, and rang some bells on the way up. Tom Seaman is the author of Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. Tom Seaman did indeed grow up in the projects in Toledo, Ohio. He got out and went to Yale for his undergraduate degree, eventually earning a top law degree at Harvard. Tom has owned several businesses and still lives in Massachusetts. Tom Seaman, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here, Jeffrey.
So start with the general conditions of your childhood. The numbers alone are rather surprising. How many people and what kind of house?
Yeah, so I grew up in a family of 14, you know, 12 kids and two parents in the projects in Toledo. And, you know, the book opens with us moving from one project area to another in Toledo. And the first one is, you know, less than probably 800 feet. And by that time, my mother already has 9 kids. So there's 11 of us living in this really tiny unit that's part of a, you know, a 3-unit building. You know, looks very stark. There's a picture of it in the beginning of the book. Looks very stark, you know, no trees, no embellishments, just a flat roof and a brick building. Looks more like a prison. And then we move to a freestanding house in another area of the project. So it's a big moment for us, but of course it's not large enough for the eventual 14 people living there, but we make it work. And so that's kind of the description of the environment. It's mostly a black neighborhood that I moved to. And that's where I come from as well. Originally, both neighborhoods were primarily African American. And so we're white. And so that also has some interesting elements in the story.
There's all kinds of ways that the story can go and certainly did. 3 pages in, though, I'm wondering if your mother is real. She seems completely unflappable.
Yeah, my mom, just an amazing person, an amazing hard worker. But what I like to say about her is, you know, not just a hard worker, an extremely hard worker, but goes the extra mile in everything that she does. And I think that served as a great example to me. So when she makes a dessert, and she made them almost every day, she would not just make simple cookies. You know, she would make complex cookies where she would roll out the dough and cut squares and put a little apricot thing in the middle and then fold them up, you know, each one folding the corners by hand and then making these dozens and dozens of cookies or pies or whatever for these kids. And as soon as she makes them, a couple hours later, they're completely gone, you know. And so the question always is, why make the extra effort? And, you know, my mom just represented that. And I think in life, when you go that extra mile or make the extra effort, it pays off. Like, maybe not the first time, maybe not the second time, but people notice. People know when you do that. People know when you're performing so well. Yeah.
She definitely comes across as an amazing person. Your father, on the other hand, sounds like a creature of, to be polite, some detachment.
Yes. And before we go on from my mother, one more thing. She's still alive at 92, and she's in Toledo, and she's still completely all there. So she's still an amazing person.
Wow.
My father, much more difficult. Yes. My father, you know, an alcoholic who is separately from being an alcoholic, I think was a mean person, you know, just had something in his past, never could figure out quite what it was that made him that way. But I think he definitely did not like his life or how it had turned out and took it out on his family. And on his wife, and she just dealt with it as though, not enabling it, but dealt with it in order to keep the family together, as though some of his outrageous statements or demands weren't so outrageous, you know, as they were. So she would just treat some crazy statement like, well, I don't want to use bad words, but, you know, you effing whore, you know, you give all the best food to the kids. You know, that seems like a silly statement for a parent to make, given that the kind of parent I am. But those are the kind of things he would do. And my mother would say, oh, Harry, you know, that's not true. And she would just deal with it as though it was a legitimate claim or something, you know, even though it was just embarrassingly immature. But yeah, so my mother dealt with him incredibly. And my siblings and I, some, I think, dealt with the difficult circumstances better than others. And I became definitely probably the leader of the confrontationalists, you know, who confronted him as I grew up. And there's a scene in the book where there's a little bit of a changing of the guard where my brother and I confront him in a way that now we're approaching manhood and we're bigger than he is physically, and he's no longer completely in control. You know, we don't take over control, but he's no longer 1,000% in control. And I think that's a very key moment in the family's life. And I do think that the kids who came after us, especially the younger half, had a slightly more, you know, they still had a very difficult father, believe me, but not as difficult as maybe the first half had.
Tom Siemens, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. To be fair to your father, he did make some contributions, like putting a bunch of crayfish in the bathtub. What was that about?
Yeah, I did. I really didn't want my father to be a one-dimensional character. I didn't want it to be evil, evil, evil. And so I interviewed all my siblings and my mother, and we tried to find, I tried to find things that were positive about him. And most of my siblings said, no, there's not really much positive there. But we did find a few elements. He did have a habit of bringing things home, funny things home sometimes that we might eat. And one of them was, you know, duck blood soup. There's a scene, and one of them was these crayfish that he thought my mother was going to cook into a stew. But when he dumped them in the bathtub, by the way, we didn't have a shower for 14 people. We only had a bathtub and a small little bathroom for the whole family. And he dumps them in the bathtub, and, you know, we start playing around with them, and we convince, you know, my mother not to cook them. And eventually they start dying and rotting and smelling. And so one day we come home and they're all gone. But for those few days, no one was bathing because there was no other alternative in the house. So it's kind of a funny scene, yes.
So that incident, from what you tell us in the book, started your original list of animals. Tell us about that list.
Yeah, so my first list was wild animals I have seen. So I would go out, you know, into the field behind our house, which I thought was a fascinating field. But when I look back at it as an adult, it was a dumping ground for people driving by with their stuff out of their truck. You would find old parts, you would find glass, you would find bricks, you know, construction debris. And the field also seemed so large to me as a child. But of course, when you grow up, it's this tiny little area of overgrown weeds. But I would see a snake or a rat or something like that, and then I had these crayfish, and so I created this list of animals I have seen. And later in the book, I lose that list, and I start a new, more forward-looking list called Animals I Want to See One Day. And that's where the title of the book comes from, because it's sort of like a metaphor for all of my dreams, you know, because how could a child in the projects be creating a list on which he's putting an elephant or whatever, and think that he would have the money and time and ability to travel the world and actually see these animals in the wild, you know? So I was a believer in myself from a very early age, very strong believer.
Despite, of course, the environment outside the walls of your house, and granted there were tough enough things in there with your father, but you lived in a series of neighborhoods where poverty was high and hope pretty low, and some tough kids in that environment. How did you handle the ones who targeted you?
Yeah, well, you know, when we first moved to our new house, you know, once again, we were white, and so we were naturally noticed. Plus, we were just a new family, probably any new family. And so I took a few punches for sure. But gradually, you know, you're accepted into the neighborhood as a family that belongs there. And, you know, the community starts to do kind acts. And I think the book is not just a book about my growing up in that environment and eventually making a successful life, but it's a book about all the small kindnesses done for me along the way. And I knew that those were done before I started writing the book, but I guess I didn't realize quite how many, because as you're putting them on paper, you know, you start to realize, wow, a lot of this book is about these others helping me along the way, both in the neighborhood and out eventually as I get out of the neighborhood, outside of the neighborhood. I had a lot of mentors and helpers along the way. You know, one example would be, you know, the guy across the street who takes us fishing. He's not thinking that this act is going to change a life. He probably just wants to go fishing, right? And he doesn't have any sons. So he takes three of us boys. You know, in the 70s, it's kind of an interesting scene because he's black and we're white and we're on the shores of Lake Erie fishing together, you know, and he's teaching us how to bait a hook and how to do these things. And I look at him and think, wow, you know, he would be an interesting man to have as a father. But anyhow, he takes us fishing and he doesn't think that's going to change a life. And that probably didn't. But when you add up all the kindnesses that are done and all the things that get me out of my neighborhood and allow me to start to see the world, you know, it changes a life, you know.
Was it Mr. Noble? Was that really his name? The man across the street?
It is not his real name. So, you know, when you write a memoir, what happens is, you know, you write the book with all the real names up to the very end because, of course, you know who they are. And then at the very end, you change some of the names based on what a lawyer tells you to do, mm-hmm. which names you might want to change. And so I made a change key where I changed the names. And so sometimes I'm talking to someone and they say something like, you know, what about Mr. Everett? And I'm like, who's Mr. Everett? You know, because you change them so at the last minute that you can't remember who you changed whom to, you know. So it's pretty funny. But Mr. Noble, I remember very, very well. And I won't say his real name, but he was a very... you know, he wasn't a very important man in my life, but he definitely was always across the street. And in several instances in the book, you see him coming to my aid.
We're talking to Tom Seaman about his book, Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. It's kind of funny, though, because one of your friends, a kid you identify as Jeffrey in the book, pointed out you live in the projects, and he was right about the prospects for kids growing up there generally, wasn't he?
Yes. I mean, yeah, I'm having a conversation with Jeffrey about the fact that I want to go around the world and see these animals and meet other people. And he says, you have to remember you live in the projects. How are you even thinking about that? And so I tell him that I'm going to go places. And so, but he's right. You know, a lot of the kids that were in those projects with me did not get out. You know, there was a family two doors away from us that had a lot of problems. You've read the book. I know it's the family where the son frankly kills the mother by bludgeoning her to death. But that entire family, so all the kids, there were six kids, I think, and two parents, roughly our ages, the entire family is dead today. All the kids, the parents, and everything. Whereas us, a family of 12 kids and two parents, we're all alive except for my father. So it's kind of a remarkable difference in outcome.
Really, really. To talk about the group you hung out with in the neighborhood, who were the Halfs?
Yeah, so I start hanging around with these guys in about sixth or seventh grade, and the Halfs are, we're called the Halfs. We call ourselves the Halfs, and we think we're very clever, you know, as young kids do, because half of us are white and half of us are black. Two of us are white and two of us are black. And I start hanging around with them, and they're across a walking bridge over the highway, which is not very far from my house, and I walk over the walk bridge to another neighborhood next door. And in that neighborhood, when I get there and start hanging around with them, one of them is in my class, I see that they're very much in control of their neighborhood, unlike, say, in my neighborhood where I don't feel I have as much control. So I'm hanging around with them, playing a lot of basketball, but starting to do some bad things as well, you know. And so it's a very, I think, important moment in my life when I get a scholarship to a college prep high school, which removes me from that environment in a big way, because I was definitely starting to do some things that, if we were caught, we would be considered crimes, you know, not major crimes, but, you know, a lot of vandalism, you know, we were dropping pumpkins on the highway, on cars on the highway, you know, entering, I guess, breaking and entering technically into an old trailer in someone's yard and, you know, looking around in that, things like that. So probably, you know, headed in a slightly bad direction. And, you know, I always feared getting caught. I always feared having a police record. As so many kids in the neighborhood did. I feared certain things that I thought could impair my ability to be a big success in life, but yet I still did some of those bad things, right?
Right.
So I guess I didn't have enough fear, right?
But some other moments of resolve here, for example, talking to your fourth grade class about your father, who, as you've already pointed out, was very cruel to your mother. What did you tell your fourth grade class about your father?
Yeah, so in the fourth grade, we were asked, each of the kids in the class was asked to tell the greatest thing each of their parents had given them. And as all the kids stand up before me and are saying all these very flowery things about their parents, I stand up and I say, the greatest thing my mother has ever given me is that she's always there to help me. And the greatest thing my father has given me is an example of what I don't want to be, which is pretty remarkable for a fourth grader. I think it shows maybe I'm an odd kid, but I'm a very confident kid, obviously. And my teacher gasps, and, you know, kids in the class can't believe it. But, you know, it really was how it was, and it really is what I said, and it really is how I looked at him, you know. And I also took a vow, if you remember, to never take a drink of alcohol in my life, except for my father. And I've also lived up to that. I've lived up to all but one pledge in the book. Yeah, I've lived up to. So
really, not a drop of alcohol your whole life?
Not a drop of alcohol my whole life.
Wow. Yep. You really took you really took charge of your life pretty early.
Yes. I think the book is a little bit about that as well, about how you can create your own life, perform your own life, you know, by, I suppose, setting rules and being very self-disciplined, which I think I was, being a very hard worker, which I think I was, loving work, including manual work, and always doing it, like my mother, to the extra mile. You know, when I clean toilets, I would reach behind the toilet and clean with my hand in a rag. I have no problem, by the way, with mess. I'm famous for that. And you know, why would I do that? You know, I couldn't not clean behind the toilet. But most people, of course, would never do that. And no one ever knew, right? It wasn't like someone was watching over me and I was showing off. But eventually, when you do those things, and you consistently do the extra mile, people do notice, and it does lead to better and better opportunities in life.
Tom Seamans, our guest. His book is Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. We'll pick up the conversation on the other side of a break. This is the Jefferson Exchange. We'll be back. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're getting a story of one man whose life started in poverty and some squalor in a neighborhood in Toledo, Ohio. Tom Seamans is his name. He's now a lawyer and a successful business owner in the Massachusetts area, in Boston area. His book is Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. We were talking about the fact that you took charge of your life pretty early. You know, you made pledges like no drinking, no stealing. But, you know, your mom was very busy, obviously, with 11 other kids in the house, ultimately, and your dad not much of a resource, abusive when he did speak. So you mentioned mentors. Who did you turn to for help and guidance, Tom?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of people along the way that did small things. You know, Mr. Hobo down the street was always barbecuing and would always give us a taste of barbecue. Once again, small acts, but they give us a sense of belonging in our community. But I would say some of the ones that really deserve mention, someone in particular would be, for example, Coach Gary, you know, my elementary school football coach, who was the first high energy, like, let's go, boys, let's go get them, you know, that kind of guy. The first high energy person or adult that I really met who could inspire young kids. And, you know, we were a ragtag bunch from a really small school that never really did that well. And we had old equipment and everything. You know, the teams we would play would have brand new face masks and, you know, cool helmets, and we would come with, you know, one or two bars across our face. And he convinced us that we were champions, even as we were losing. And twice during my time there, we went to the championship game. So, and we had never been to the championship before. So I think someone like that is very important to showing a young boy a lot of attention, a lot of praise. You know, the one thing about my mother that I do point out in the book is that she was, you know, short on praise, I would say. I even have this scene where, you know, she does so much for me, and I'm thinking about the fact that she won't praise me. And, you know, my little shame angel appears on my shoulder and says, hasn't she done enough? And of course she's done enough, right? But you still, as a child, always want your parents' praise. And my mother would, first of all, not give much praise because she's so busy with everything else, probably didn't even think about it. But in particular, for me, wouldn't praise me, even though I felt that I was excelling, right? So I would come home and say, hey, Mom, I'm going to Yale. And she would say, oh, that's great. Can you pass me that screwdriver? You know, or something like that, you know. No question about how did you do it? How are you going to pay for it? How are you going to get there? You know, all these things that I, frankly, take care of myself. So I forget where this question began, but about mentors and about praise.
Right.
So I think I sought approval outside of the house a lot because of that. And so I always wanted to be teacher's pet. I wanted to be the coach's favorite. I wanted to do my best to always get praise, which probably helped drive me.
And there were certainly two additions to your crowded house that made life better, one more permanent than the other. World Book Encyclopedia was the permanent one, and a dog. Tell us about the dog.
Yeah, so her name is Kathy. And, you know, we did have an array of strays, frankly. Whenever strays came by, we would adopt them for a short time, and then we would lose them. But Taffy, in particular, stayed with us longest and was very important to me. There's a scene in the book where I say, I'm cuddling with her, and I say, you know, I said to her something that I had never said before and that had never been said to me. And I said, I love you, Taffy. I'm actually tearing up right now. Kind of weird. Sorry about that.
No problem.
But and then she's taken away because the housing authority doesn't allow you to have pets in the projects. And it's understandable, right, why they don't, because of all the potential damage. The houses are already beat up with these, you know, 14 occupants in this small house. And so allowing pets would probably be one more step, but they didn't allow pets. And so every once in a while they would come by and say, you got to get rid of that dog. And so one day I come home and Taffy is gone, you know, and my father had had, and one of the good things my father did, he found a home for her with someone at work, which was a good thing. But I sort of yell at him, you know, how could you do that to me? How could you not at least let me say goodbye? And then I write a letter to the, I ask my mom if I can write a letter to the housing authority explaining why it would be a good idea for us to be allowed to have pets in the project, which of course goes nowhere, but it's kind of, once again, an interesting scene about how I thought as a child.
And in the beginning of you pleading cases as a lawyer, it sounds like, too.
Well, just to be clear, I did graduate from law school, but I only practiced on Wall Street for 2 years, and ever since then I've been in business. So I'm not a lawyer. I've never pled a case in court. So just to be clear.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So back to the world books, it sounds like it was kind of like me with the Collier's Encyclopedia as a kid, just kind of, you know, wearing out all the pages. And I wonder, you mentioned already, this is not a loveless house, but not big on affection either. You wanted your mother to tell you she loved you, and she didn't much. But do you think intellect took the place of emotion for you to some degree, Tom?
Yeah, and maybe it still does, right? I, to be honest, I think I have a very high IQ and a more limited EQ. You know, I think I have some EQ, but I don't think my EQ is as high as my IQ. I don't know if that comes from my upbringing or is naturally how I am, you know. But, yeah, so my mother, who couldn't afford anything, for some reason allowed this encyclopedia salesman into our house. And it's surprising to me looking back that the encyclopedia salesman was even going door to door in our neighborhood, because how many sales would he probably make, right? Because it's not a very high-income neighborhood at all. But anyhow, she lets him in, and I come home, and there he is, and he's showing her the World Book and explaining how you can afford it, because you buy them unit by unit, right? So if you buy the A volume and you can't afford the B volume, you don't get it until you can afford it. So you're buying them along the way and building the set. So she, after a lot of me looking through the books and some of my siblings and me being fascinated by it, she turns the corner and says that she will buy it. And it becomes a very important part of my life. I, you know, would sit around looking through the World Book. It helps with your homework as well, before the internet, of course. But I would read through it and learn things and find animals I want to see in the wild one day. Yeah, there's several scenes in the book where I'm learning things from the encyclopedia. You know, the first art I'm really looking at, that's outside of the house, looking at foreign countries where I eventually want to go. Just a really eye-opening experience for me.
Tom Seaman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. Well, let's pause for a moment and talk about the results of all the places you made plans to see and the animals you wanted to see. Did you fulfill the list? Have you been to many of the countries you wanted to go to?
Oh, yes. I've been to over 100 countries in my life, and I've seen, I often, not every trip, but I often make seeing a particular animal a part of the trip. And I still do that with my family today. So we sometimes take trips to places that are just nice, but we often take trips to places to, in particular, target one or two animals. And my children have gotten into it as well. So fortunately, I've achieved enough that I can afford to do that and take my family to these far-off places. And our next one is next year. We're going to Malaysia to see the orangutans in the wild. You know, as these wild habitats shrink, the chances to see these things in the wild are getting rarer and rarer. So we're trying to get a few in before they all end up in enclosures, I suppose, or something, you know, because the wild is disappearing.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, that's a noble goal. I want to come back to your school days, though. You mentioned getting a scholarship to high school, but even before that, you were in Catholic school in a family of 12 kids and very little money. How did that work out? How did you afford Catholic school?
Yeah, we were allowed to go for free. So my mother went to the school and asked the priest, Father Schmelzer, you know, I can't afford to pay, I think it was like $100 a student, and then it diminished as the numbers of students rose in the family, but I can't afford to pay the $100, let alone $1, right? And so Father Schmelzer let us go to the school in return for our work, and that's where I became a child janitor in the third grade, where mostly in the summer, I and some of my siblings would go to the school, and there would be a real janitor there, and he would supervise us, and we would clean the entire school, including, like, you know, pretty quickly in my life, running the machines, like the scrubber machine and the buffer machine across the floors, taking all the desks out of a classroom, stacking them, you know, going in, doing the floors, doing the walls, putting it all back in. So my summer, from a very young age, was occupied with being a school janitor And that's how we got to go to the school.
Wow. So what do you think? I mean, would you have done as well if you'd gone to the local public school in Toledo?
I know. I think there's a lot of questions like that. There's also a question in my mind is if I had been born into a wealthy family, would I have been as driven or as motivated? Of course, I'll never know, but I have thought about that. But would I have been as successful? I think the string of schools I was allowed to go to was very, very important because I did have the attention of teachers. It's not that public school teachers don't care, obviously, but they have many more kids in their classes. And I think they had, at least in the schools near us, much more disruptive kids in many cases in the school. You know, the local public school, the grade school nearby, was known to be pretty tough. So I think it would have been hard for me to go from there to getting a scholarship to a college prep high school, which is what eventually happened. Yeah.
Talk about, apart from school, how you began to work your way into not being poor. I mean, you took some early forays into the business world. How did you make money? What did you do?
Yeah, so I would do odd jobs, like in the winter, go around with a snow shovel and offer to shovel people's walks in the neighborhood next to ours, where people, it wasn't at all a well-off neighborhood, but it was a slightly better neighborhood. And they would, you know, pay you to shovel their walk or do some raking or do things like that. But then I had the idea of buying a paper route. The local paper is called the Toledo Blade. And the routes then cost $1 a customer, but you were able to buy them by paying the current owner, who was some kid that was probably going to go off to high school, and you would buy his route out of your earnings over time. And so I bought a paper route, and I later bought a second paper route and added to that paper route. And with no showing and throwing any shade on my siblings, in many of these cases, I was always the first person in my family to do these things, to do things like this, to be the child janitor, to be the first to buy a paper route, and frankly, to be the first in my family to go to a Catholic high school, which was a college prep high school far from my neighborhood. The siblings before me all went to the public high school because that just seemed to be the way to go. But I had this idea in my mind that I would have a much more successful life if I went to a much better high school. And in Toledo, all the private high schools are the Catholic schools. And we happen to be Catholic, which helped too. But so I was the first to take the Catholic school's admissions test. And I calculated that I could afford with my paper route and my other odd jobs the least expensive school called Central Catholic. But when I took the exam, I did so well that the top high school in Toledo, an all-boys Catholic school, where you wore a coat and tie. It was known as the Sissy School in my neighborhood because of the coat and tie. They came to my school and got me and told me that I could go to their school for free based on my test score. So this was the beginning of a very, very big change in my life.
Yeah, major boost, obviously, to getting you on campus at Yale University. Talk about that transition. I mean, how different was being in New Haven from being in Toledo in the projects?
Yeah, I mean, a very, very big difference. I mean, I think I had the fortunate step of going to St. Francis for high school, which at least got me surrounded by, certainly wasn't wealthy the way Yale was, or as high achieving as Yale was, but it was definitely more high achieving students in my class that I was competing with. I was going to school with the sons of doctors and things like that, which I did not have in my neighborhood. So I was getting some exposure to that kind of life in Toledo, at least. But when you get to Yale, it's a whole nother level. And in many ways, I wasn't prepared. But I was, you know, I was very driven, and I was driving myself very, very hard at Yale to the point where, you know, there's a scene where I'm crying at my desk because of the stress I'm putting myself under. I definitely drove myself very hard, and I ended up, you know, doing very, very well academically at Yale. Never would have predicted that coming. You know, when I think back and I showed up, you know, I was, there's a scene in the book where when I moved to Yale, I don't have a suitcase. So my mother finds an old suitcase in my grandmother's attic. And so I'm carrying, you know, a suitcase from like 1931, and I couldn't fit everything in it. So I'm wearing 5 pairs of pants, you know, one pair over the other. Some of them were shorts and some of them were long pants. And I show up at my dorm, and of course, not everybody at Yale is wealthy, but no one is quite like me. And I show up with 5 pairs of pants and this old suitcase. And I remember one of the parents of one of my freshman roommates, when I graduated from Yale summa cum laude, that they were like shocked, you know, because they didn't foresee that for this kid that they met when he was this freshman ragtag kind of kid, you know?
It's a really impressive story. The book is called Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds by Tom Seaman, who did all those things. Tom, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great.
And that will do it for today's exchange. Check out this interview and more on our website, jeffexchange.org. Angela Decker of JPR News is our senior producer. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.